KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Mid-50s.
Mitt's prepared. Mitt's confident. Mitt's got a good presence about him.
I suppose you could use Miracle-Gro on herbs, but I don't know why you would.
I think he'll do fine. I think he just has to get out there and talk about what he's done for the country and what he wants to do for the next 4 years.
We'll be gardening today. We'll also be talking about the debates right now. And we're going to talk about a daredevil, too, and what it takes to be a daredevil. President Obama and Governor Romney, as you know, appear in the second debate tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific time. You can be listening on KUOW. You can be watching on television. So what would you be watching for? What are the skills and mannerisms they've probably been practicing? But also, what do voters actually listen to over the course of this debate? David Domke is a professor of communication. He's also at the University of Washington School of Journalism. Runs that. Hello, David Domke.
Good morning.
You're on the phone somewhere driving. Where are you driving? Portland?
I'm going towards Portland, but I am not driving right now, so don't worry.
I knew that, of course. I didn't mean to even imply that. What did you see, just by way of getting started? What did you see at the last debate?
Well, it's a good question, Steve. I've been doing a lecture series with Seattle Arts and Lectures and the UW Alumni Association every other week for the last 10 weeks of the campaign, and we talked about the debates on Thursday. And my big point is that these debates are not informational moments. They're relational moments. And that means that the key for the candidates is to connect with the public through television as opposed to providing, you know, a litany of facts. And what I saw was one candidate who was deeply attempting to be relational, and that would be Mitt Romney, and one candidate who was busy being informational, and that was Barack Obama. And in that kind of environment, the relational candidate will always be perceived as the better debater, the better presidential candidate. And I think that Barack Obama will, that's his challenge for tonight, is to turn that around.
Why would Barack Obama, who was given so much credit as a relational candidate in the campaign in 2008, not necessarily in the debates, why would you shift? Is that an incumbent's necessity or even a tendency?
Well, I think two things, Steve. One is that incumbents haven't had the recent debate experience that the challenger has. So, you know, Mitt Romney had 20-plus debates from basically mid-2011 through June 2012, and Obama hasn't had any debates since 2008. So just being rusty, and we see first debates always go to the challengers. That's been a pattern for the last 30 years. Now, this one went epically for the challenger, but the fact that the president doesn't do well is almost always the case in the first debate. I think the second thing here is it's got more to do with the president, though, as opposed to just the structure of it, which is that the president is not someone who is a great debater, actually. He's a great speech giver, and he's effective governor. But he is not someone who thrives on that debate kind of moment. And I think that not having other voters in the room, not having people to kind of look in their eyes and feed off of that, really worked against his – it did not help him, and he did not make the strategic adjustments that were necessary. So I think that we make a mistake if we think that Obama is a really effective communicator in all settings. He is not, and I think that that setting was not one of them.
Right. And David Domke, some people are saying, well, in the town hall format, the president has more opportunities to connect. But so does Mitt Romney, of course. So do they have different strategies?
I think they do tonight. I mean, Romney's clearly got momentum right now, although the recent polls, like in the last couple, 3 days, have suggested things have started to settle. With maybe Obama up just slightly nationally. But Romney has clearly come from a couple points back, so he's got some momentum there. And I think he just needs to sustain that. And by doing that, the way he does that tonight is to show that he's not a robot, that he can connect with people in this setting. He doesn't have to make himself the life of the party. He doesn't need to be Bill Clinton. He doesn't need to seduce people personally in that kind of setting. But he needs to be able to show some connection. Barack Obama needs to show that people don't doubt that he can connect with them. What he needs to do is show them that he'll fight for them. That's what they did not get. And that's part of the relational piece. Is this a guy, a president, who's going to fight for me when times are tough? And that's what people questioned after that first debate. Would he fight for them? So I think you're going to see a lot more vigor, a lot more Joe Biden in Barack Obama tonight.
Yeah, I mean, Mitt Romney came across as a guy who was fighting, right?
Yeah, and that was the epic shift that occurred there, because he had been painted by the Obama campaign for months and months as somebody who would not fight for the middle class or for the broad American electorate. And Mitt Romney had confirmed that in various moments, like his 47% comments. But then he got into the debate, he became much more moderate, and he came across as the guy who was going to fight for the general public. So Obama needs to show, hey, I'm the fighter for the general public, and this guy across the way here, he's the one who actually has been saying for months and months that he would fight only for the rich. That's the two-pronged strategy of Obama tonight.
David Domke is professor of communication. He's head of journalism at the University of Washington, co-author with Kevin Coe of The God Strategy, How Religion Became a Political Weapon in America. That's from 2008. You know, I read two different analyses. I'm sorry. I'm a little punchy after the A word. I read two different analyses of what was happening. And one was from the Wall Street Journal, Gerald Seib. He said Barack Obama has to show what vision he has for the future, like something positive. What's his plan? And I also read another analysis that said, well, you know, what happened in the debate was that Barack Obama showed he doesn't have a plan, and therefore he doesn't have something that he can offer up, whereas Mitt Romney can simply, this is what this analyst said, lie, and it doesn't matter. You're not called on it. You can shift and shift and then shift again, and voters don't mind. Why don't voters mind in the modern world if politicians flip-flop, is what the old frame used to be, so much?
Well, I think that the foundational start for politicians is that they don't start with a tremendous amount of credibility or love among the public. So the public expects, it's almost taken for granted that candidates will shape-shift some of their positions. And when other candidates don't go after them on that shape-shifting, then the public is likely to say, okay, that's just the way it goes. And that's, you know, Obama did not call out Romney on that in the first debate. When Romney's been running as, in his words, a severely conservative candidate for about 5 years now, and suddenly he became the moderate, the guy who governed Massachusetts, the moderate. He became that person again in the debate, and Barack Obama just said, okay. Well, you know, you can't expect the public to get upset about that if Romney's primary opponent isn't upset about it. So I think that the answer to your question, Steve, I think, is that the public takes cues from a candidate opponents. And the cue they got from the president was that this shift by Romney, it's okay. I think that what Joe Biden, the cue he sent was, no, it's not okay, and we're calling you out on it. And it clearly that excited the Democratic supporters, but also seemed to play pretty well with moderates in the vice presidential debate. So I expect the same thing from Barack Obama. Will it be forward-looking vision for Obama? It will be a mix of his forward-looking vision with also critique of Romney and his lack of specificity or his shifting.
So then Mitt Romney, does he have to be more specific, or does he simply have to continue to show that he's fighting for you?
I think the latter. I think it's a done decision on the Romney camp that he's not going to be more specific. He's just not. They have said in so many moments, at so many places, that they are not going to fill out the details of his tax plan or his economic strategy until after the election. And that's the position they've taken. They affirmed it just yesterday again. So I don't think you're going to see anything more specific from him. What you're going to see is somebody trying to connect. That's been his biggest deficit, continuing to try to connect. Not going to be on policies, it's going to be on connection.
You know, David, this race is essentially tied in a lot of the state polling as well as the national polls. I know those are two different things. What is the history of the second debate and even the third debate with an incumbent, with a challenger, when it's tied like this?
I'm glad you asked, because that's something I've been talking about in some of my talks I'm doing. There's a narrative arc Steve, to kind of use a big term, a narrative arc that encompasses all of the debates. And we know what that arc is after you see all three debates, but you don't know what it is yet. So far, the arc has definitely favored Romney, although Biden kind of checked it in the second debate. That arc so far looks like the 2004 debate arc, in which John Kerry really took it to George Bush in the first debate, and then Dick Cheney kind of checked things in the VP debate. What happens now in the second presidential debate is really the crucial moment. Does Mitt Romney's momentum from debate one continue, or does Barack Obama come back? We saw George Bush come back in 2004, and it stopped John Kerry's momentum, and Bush went on, of course, to win by a couple points. I think that tonight is the crucial debate. Whatever happens in debate three will follow from debate two. So this is the moment in which Obama's got to come back, seize the mantle, seize the leadership. And they know this. Since debate one, they've been saying quite clearly, you'll see a different Obama tonight. You'll see a different Obama tonight. They would not be saying that publicly unless they wanted to tell all their supporters, look, we know we messed up. We'll be back.
And they did mess up. Do they know that the first debate was a failure? There wasn't any, like, secret plan to lower expectations in order to enhance the second debate's expectations?
Well, you know, there are people who sometimes say that the president is so smart that he's playing, like, 20-dimensional chess and that he's, you know, all these steps ahead. And so they might point to that first debate and say it was all part of the plan. I don't think so. I don't think you mess up that badly. The Gallup polling organization has shown was the most convincing debate victory for any presidential candidate for Mitt Romney ever. You don't mess up that badly as part of a plan. Maybe you kind of like do not great, but you don't do that badly. But I think they also are smart enough to know that there are these ups and downs in campaigns, and he had a few points that he could spare to lose. If he comes back strong tonight, then the people that have gotten a little discouraged, they'll be back. He hasn't lost in the polls, Steve, support for him. What he's done is lost people that were probably leaning Romney and just needed reason to go to Romney. They have. So he doesn't need to persuade people. All he needs to do is show them, I'm with you. And he'll get back, not a full 4-point lead, but he'll get back, in my view, a couple-point lead.
Yeah, but Mitt Romney has fought really hard. Mitt Romney has come back and showed himself succeeded to be the credible candidate.
He absolutely has, and that's been their strategy from the beginning, was that they would win this election in October. They actually thought they'd win in September and October. They missed their chance at the convention, made all kinds of mistakes there, and so then it really came down to the debates. And you got to give them credit. Mitt Romney came ready to go in that first debate, and Barack Obama was not. So they have executed in October so far. Now the vaunted Obama campaign with its ground game, with his strategy, it's time for them to execute. And, you know, frankly, I think it's a reasonable thing for the public to say, look, we've been split on you. Some of us think you're the greatest. Some of us think you're the worst. But we need to see you, Mr. President, execute as this game gets down to the line. And, you know, and that's the question for him. And let's see tonight.
All right, David Domke, thanks a lot. David Domke is heading down to Portland. He is professor of communication. He's head of journalism at the University of Washington. He's co-author with Kevin Coe of The God Strategy, How Religion Became a Political Weapon in America. And, of course, as you probably heard from Kevin Overby as well, there's all that money waiting in the wings to be spent by all those other organizations. And they've got their own powder dry and ready to fire after these debates. This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 10:19. I'm Andy Hurst. Very few people on the outside know what goes on inside the Church of Scientology. Its rituals are carefully guarded secrets. But Mark Headley knows. He grew up in the church and rose to prominence within it. But what he saw there compelled him to flee. He tells the story in his book, Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. Mark Headley is our guest this afternoon at 2:20.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
We have cloudy skies and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 54 degrees in the University District. Working towards a high today of 55, forecast says partly sunny later with a chance of showers. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of showers, the low in the mid-40s, partly sunny tomorrow, the high in the mid-50s.
Gardening coming up on weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. Millions of people watched Felix Baumgartner break the sound barrier during his record-setting 24-mile free fall this past weekend. Katie Sewell has been thinking about what makes a daredevil.
Yeah, over 8 million people watched him on YouTube, which was a viewing record for that site. But really, daredevils are nothing new. Before they even got wide media coverage, people were still firing themselves out of cannons and walking on tightropes. So I invited Rick Walenda to join us to talk about this. Rick Walenda is part of the family line of high wire performers. He's the eldest grandson of Carl and Helen, the founders of the Great Walendas. And he now performs and runs Walenda Enterprises Incorporated. He's completed many skywalks, including the one that killed his grandfather in San Juan, and set a new record when he walked a span of 2,000 feet at Kings Island, Ohio. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Hi.
Hi. So, Rick, what did you think of Felix Baumgartner's flight this weekend?
Wow, I thought it was awesome, incredible. I don't even like getting on things that fly, let alone jumping out of one.
Well, how can you say that when you're not afraid to walk on a tightrope?
Well, my wire stays right there, see, and I can stay right on top of it, and that's fine with me.
Well, what do you think makes a daredevil in your opinion? Would you define yourself as one?
Oh, absolutely. What we do is daredevil work, and it's difficult to try to define that. I grew up around Carl Walenda, the greatest daredevil that I know, and he was good friends with Evel Knievel. So I stood in the shadow of these two great daredevils, and that just inspired me to want to go on and do great things.
So I'm hoping that maybe you can put us a little bit in the place of what you're feeling and what Felix Baumgartner might have been feeling. When you're thinking about taking on a task that has a lot of implicit danger, how are you weighing the risk of your life against the glory and the adrenaline that you'll get from doing this?
Well, first of all, Felix, that wasn't his first jump. So, you know, he's had practice. He had to train to work up to that. In the same way we train, we start somebody just inches off the ground. And our family is, that's one of the things that we do. We train new daredevils. I'm training two kids right now, an 18-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl. And if you saw from my webpage, I had a young girl, she's 14 now. She started with me when she was 9 years old. She's the youngest person in history to do these daredevil stunts. And what we do, we train people. I don't know how other people look at it, but for me, from my perspective, what I like to think, I know there are people out there that want to see us get hurt and want to see us fail, but I would say the vast majority of people wanted to see Felix succeed, and they want to see me succeed, and they wanted to see my cousin Nick succeed when he walked across Niagara, because that inspires them to be able to overcome whatever hurdles they might have in their own life.
So what does it feel like before you step off that building under a wire that's way above a crowd?
Oh, that is not necessarily the best feeling of the whole thing. I'm nervous. I do get nervous. And I'm looking at the rigging because I know my grandfather was killed largely because of a rigging mishap. And so I'm checking the rigging. I'm watching everything that's going on. I'm doing a visual of everything that's going on to make sure that everything's safe because I don't want to get hurt. It's not in the heart of a daredevil to want to be hurt. You know, we're not suicidal people. We want to succeed. And so at the very beginning, that's what I'm looking at. And once I get 20 feet away from the building, I'm good. I'm good to go then. I'm fine. I'm making it across to the other side. I'll do my headstand or whatever I do in the middle. And when I get to the other side and I hear the audience roar and I know that I did something that they're impressed with, something that only a handful of people in the whole world can do, that's the thrill at the end of it for me.
So one of the things that you did, as you kind of indicated there, is, I mean, your grandfather got killed doing this and you completed the same walk he did. What Can you explain a little bit more what happened to him and why you decided to try to take on that same spot?
Sure. He was 73 years old. He had broken his neck a few months earlier, and then there was a gust of wind. My mom checked, and there was a gust of wind that was 40 to 45 miles an hour right when he was standing on that wire. But the biggest problem was that the rigging was not guyed out properly. And had I been there, and I was supposed to have been there with him, had I been there, I would have set it up properly, and he would have went on. I don't know how much longer he would have went on, but he would have went on beyond that. So when that mishap happened, in our family, we don't like to leave our fans in a condition where they think that we failed.
Mm-hmm.
Just like when the seven-person pyramid collapsed in Detroit in 1962, the following year, 1963, they resurrected it, and they did it again. Because they want, and we want, everybody to see that we can succeed at this, that a failure is a minor setback. And so I went back there. NBC invited me to do this walk, and it was on a show called Daredevils. I think it aired in 1980. And I went back there. My cousin Tino erected the wire for me. I wanted somebody that was going to be really good, and more eyes than just mine watching the safety of the rigging. And so we were successful. We completed it successfully.
I'm speaking with Rick Walinda, who's part of a long family line of high wire performers, about what it's like to be a daredevil. Well, maybe just to end, are you a different type of person? Are people who are drawn to doing daredevil type acts a certain kind of person from your experience of knowing your family and knowing Evel Knievel, your grandfather knowing him?
Even in my family, I'm considered nuts. But I had a recent experience. I was able to meet Robbie Knievel. It was a long-time desire of mine to be able to meet him, and him and I are talking about doing some stunts together. And, yeah, we're different. I would say we're different. You know, how many 8 billion people on the planet? There's only a handful of us that do this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely we're different.
I think one of the main things people suspect is that you're just adrenaline junkies. Is that true?
Well, it's fun. I can tell you that. What we do is fun, but I certainly don't want to kill myself. Robbie doesn't want to kill himself. My grandfather didn't want to die, you know, either, even though the way he went would have been the way he would prefer rather than dying in bed or something. But I don't want to die doing this, no.
Well, so Baumgartner took it to the extreme. He took his daredeviling to the edge of space. What do you think is next when it comes to daredevils? What's the limit?
For him, I don't know. For me, I want to do, I have something in mind that I want to do that would break a record my grandfather has. And for him, I don't know what else he could do, jump from the moon? I don't know. There's no gravity any further out than that. How are you going to fall? You know, he's already at the edge of, and one of our slogans is exceed your limits. So we try to exceed our limits. We want to go beyond. We want to push the envelope out even further.
Are you going to give us a preview of what it is you want to do?
Yeah, I want to make his head. He did two headstands over a canyon in Georgia, and I want to do three in my next big long walk.
Well, we'll be watching for that. Rick Walinda is part of the family line of high wire performers, the eldest grandson of Carl and Helen, who founded the Great Walindas. He now performs and runs Walinda Enterprises and is constantly breaking new records. Thanks, Rick, for joining us to talk about this.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This is Weekday.
There's no video that justifies an attack on an embassy.
Washington was slow last month to identify the attackers in Benghazi.
The administration has finally conceded these attacks were the deliberate work of terrorists.
As the campaigns clash over the events in Benghazi, we hear voices from Libya about the attack and what's happened since. That's on PRI's The World.
That story and much more today at 4 on our second program service, KUOW2. We have clouds and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 55 degrees in the University District. We're expecting a high today right around 55. Forecast says partly sunny today with a chance of showers. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of showers, the low in the mid-40s.
Support for KUOW comes from the EnviroStars Business Certification Program, recognizing EnviroStar partner City of Tacoma's TAGRO program for their commitment to environmentally sustainable business practices. A directory of businesses meeting certification standards is available at envirostars.org.
KUOW and Seattle Arts and Lectures present Hari Kunzru, British essayist, journalist, and author of four novels, including Gods Without Men, at Benaroya Hall on Tuesday, October 23rd. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Our gardening panel is here. Talk about the garden, the wet, soggy garden. Oh, I see the sun is shining, isn't it? Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. You can find her work at MartyWingate.com. Her book is Landscaping for Privacy. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Greg Rayburn is here. Vashon Basin Steward works on habitat restoration and salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Islands. Helps landowners solve problems sustainably. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Willie Galloway is here, host of the gardening and cooking website DigginFood.com. Her book is Grow, Cook, Eat, here through the magic of radio from Portland. Hi, Willie.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you. What's the weather in Portland right now?
Well, it's completely sunny and gorgeous, but it was very windy and rainy yesterday, and all my tomatoes blew over.
Yeah.
They're at their very end. I was just kind of waiting, you know, to pick them all, and so nature took care of that for me. It's time to get what's ready to be picked out and then take the plants out.
And what will you do with those? So they may have split as well, right?
Well, I took a look today. I had luckily harvested almost all the really ripe ones a few days earlier, but there were a few more that were starting to ripen. They seem fine, actually. There's quite a few green tomatoes, of course, still on the plant. This is one of my grafted plants, and it's huge. It's like 7 feet tall. And so there's a lot of green tomatoes still. So I'm kind of undecided. Sometimes I'll pick green tomatoes and use them, and sometimes I'll just put them in my compost. We'll see.
Yeah, usually, right? We're always talking about green tomatoes this time of year. This was a better year. Yeah, tomatoes.
And we didn't think it was going to be a better year, but
exactly.
It was.
Play the tape from June.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So Greg has an exception to your description of the garden being soggy.
Oh, what's that?
Oh, we were just talking about it out in the green room about I went out yesterday. It was before this latest spell. But
still after an inch of rain.
Yeah, and dug in the ground. And we're talking the top centimeter of soil had actually been moistened.
So it takes a while for the soil to recharge.
Yeah. Well, those streets were wet and the leaves
were
everywhere.
Wet.
Yes.
So, okay.
I love it when the leaves start blowing around wildly. We've got big oak trees at Greenwood School, and it seems like they start to turn and they start to fall, and then, not this wind, but the next wind or the wind after that, they'll all be on the ground.
You're liking this weather.
Yeah.
Michael Fagan said, this is weather Marty Wingate's going to like.
Yeah.
Rain falling. You enjoy it. I have a drain field, Julie writes, on Bainbridge Island on the way to the view of the Sound. I had 100 lavender plants until they became too leggy. This year I tried an environmental grass mix, but that browned out early. Do I return to lavender, which I did enjoy, or are there native plants that could survive sandy, dry soil and not send lots of roots into the drain field?
I'm not sure what kind of drain field.
I bet she means septic, don't you?
Yes, but I mean, there's many different. Some there's gravity systems where the pipes are 4 feet down and you can get away with a lot of it. Sometimes you have mounds which have different kinds of plants on it. But one plant in particular, most of the perennials you can do fine. There's native lupins that would self-seed readily and would look great if you have a sunny area. On my mound septic system is in the pretty well shaded, so I have it covered with sword ferns and things like inside-out flower and columbine. And
if it's in the sun and sandy and well-drained, could she do some beech? perennials, you know, that we have, some natives.
Beach strawberry would be a good one. Also, our sedums would just thrive there. We have lots of different native sedums.
But she's got a big drain field. She's going to need a mix, right, of these plants.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would look better anyway. And if it's a big area, it's nice to have a path through there. And then, you know, just landscape it like a yard, but pick the right plant for the right place.
What do you suppose the Enviro grass mix was? Something that maybe not necessarily be native?
Probably not native. Most grass mixes, native grasses tend to be more bunch grasses, so they aren't real conducive for lawn replacement. So most of those have grasses that will creep.
Yeah, that mix was probably one of the EcoTurf mixes that has not just grass, but broadleaf perennials. And usually once they take hold, there is some green there all summer, but maybe not as much as she wanted.
I'm surprised. Usually there's yarrow in those mixes, I would expect that still to have been able to survive. She may need to do some more supplemental watering over the drain field until those plants are established. It was a long dry spell.
Does it have to be really wet for, what's our little carex? The carex
Obnupta, the slough sedge. We have a whole bunch of different sedges. My favorite lower growing one that would that handles pretty dry conditions is Carex pachystachya.
And that's low growing. And does it have a big kind of head, a broad leaf too? I mean, is it a really narrow leaf?
It's not a very broad leaf. It's not a very large sedge. The slough sedge is a much larger one.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever the carex was that I saw at Fort Flagler, you know, on the dunes, not, you know, it wasn't soggy places.
That might have been the big-headed sedge.
And some of them were small just because they were small plants. Oh. But that was a cute little thing, I'll tell you. Hmm. It was good looking.
A cute little thing. All right. Well, there's a question that we got via email. So you can email us if you have some questions about the garden, maybe some plans you're making. You can also call us at 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. You can also post on the KUOW Green Days page where we will see what you're asking and answer your questions as well. I just have a quick question for each of you. So, Willie, you're dealing with your tomatoes. Anything else?
No, everything else is just kind of settled in for the fall. Just have some general cleanup to do.
Oh, well, like what?
Oh, you know, I'm going to cut back some of my fruit sages and raking, of course, and I'm going to mulch over my beds because I didn't get a cover crop in time, so I'm going to mulch over the top of my beds for the winter. I have a few other things, some pole beans and cucumbers and a few things that are pretty much done that I need to compost.
Done and done. Our number is 206-543-5869. If you have questions for Marty, for Greg, for Willie, or 1-800-289-5869, lines open. What's in your plans for the garden?
Well, I'm going to check on the soil, just like Greg is, but I do have a collection of plants in pots that are waiting to go somewhere, and as soon as I figure out where they're going, I'll start planting.
That's what you're doing too, right?
Yeah, as well as when Willie was talking about cleaning up the vegetables. And one thing I like to do, I grow my tomatoes in containers. And one thing I want to make sure is that I then move that soil over and combine it. And I like to reuse my potting soil because it's expensive. And I'll move that, but I'll keep an area where I know that it's not going to be used for tomatoes again, so that you reduce the amount, you know, of possibility of disease transmission. And that way I can reuse that soil for potting up some native plants or something like that and not have to worry about it.
Great. All right. I want to talk about disease control in a little bit too with you guys, but let me go to Bob in Bellingham. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, I have some artichokes that I grew for the first time this year, and they were nice, and I got some artichokes off of them. I would like to know how to kind of put those down for the winter. And I'd also like to know what I should do to start some more artichokes for next summer.
Who wants that? Willie, do you want that? Have you grown artichokes?
Sure. Yeah, I grow artichokes. You know, they're pretty hardy in our area. Only if it gets super, super cold without snow do they kind of die back sometimes. So they'll be a lot bigger next year. And really, you could just spread some compost around the base if you wanted. You could mulch a little bit. Sometimes they'll get little sort of artichoke pups down on the bottom that you can dig up and transplant. Or you can also start artichoke from seed. I haven't grown them from seed myself, but from what I know, they're pretty slow growing. So you'd want to probably do that in late January to get those, or early February to get those starts going before you transplant them outside. Or you could, of course, just buy new starts next year.
Do artichokes like a lot of water at some point, or can they take it as dry as it got this later in the season?
It seems to me that the bigger ones, the ones that are a few years old, can handle more drought. But, you know, they are like any plant that you're typically harvesting something off of does better if there's some consistent moisture. So, you know, they'll grow in drier soil, but they'll probably grow bigger and faster in consistently moist soil.
Bob, you said you got artichokes this year, huh? You got to eat artichokes. Is that right, Bob?
Yeah, they're great. And I understand that they don't usually grow the first year, but if you get them if the starts go through a frost, then they might grow the first year like they did for me.
That's great. All right, Bob, thanks a lot. I admire his success because I've never been able to get my artichokes to really establish themselves. I think I don't do something right.
And have you harvested any?
Not in a long time.
Well, they're real pretty plants. Very architectural. You could just use it as an ornamental.
I guess. I think I should figure out what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah.
Our number is 206-543-5869. If you have some questions about what you're doing right or wrong, 1-800-289-5869. You can join this conversation. We're talking about gardening with Willie Galloway, with Marty Wingate, with Greg Rayburn, and with you. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. I have access to lots of cut grass, my lawn, and horse manure, Adam writes. If I mix these two, would that be a good compost? Would that be good for a compost pile? Would I need to add anything else? A little 101 on composting? He's got grass. He's got horse manure.
I'd say it would need to get pretty hot in that compost pile to kill all the weed seeds in the horse manure.
What's his ratio, horse manure to grass? Not one
really?
To one, right?
You'd probably need, you know, both grass and horse manure are really high in nitrogen. So if you mix those two together, if there's not a lot of bedding mixed in with the horse manure, like straw, it could get kind of stinky and anaerobic. So adding in a lot of shredded leaves could help. And so you want to do three parts carbon to one part nitrogen. So, you know, three parts leaves to one part manure and grass mixture.
Yeah, so he wants to get more of what you have around your land, right? Old leaves and things like that. Maybe chop up some branches.
It's a great time to find that carbon. Lots of leaves blowing around.
Yeah.
I stockpile leaves. We behind our garage, we have a little area that's covered, and I seriously go steal leaves. Last year we were in Hood River, and the city had just raked all these beautiful dry oak leaves up, and I made my husband grab as many bags as we could and put them in the back of our car before we drove home. And because I use them in my chicken run, and because they decompose really well in the chicken run and are nice in there, but they're also really good when you're making compost in the summer. There's not a lot of dry stuff around. And so it's good to have that on hand if you like to make compost year round, not just in the fall.
Yeah. All right. One more email and then I turn a phone call here. Just wondering about Willie's tomato plants and tomato plants in general. I've heard one can pull tomatoes out of the ground with the root intact, hang them upside down, cool, dry area in order to allow the rest of the green tomatoes to ripen. I'm told this really works. Has anybody actually ever seen it work? That's what Joe wants to know. Have you seen it work, Willie?
It does work. You might want to strip off some of the leaves when you do that and just leave the fruit, and you can hang them upside down. If you have rats in your garage, you might not want to do that.
No.
You can also just pick all the green tomatoes, and you want to pick ones that are on their way towards being ripe. So if they're hard as rocks and dark green, they probably aren't going to ripen inside. But if they're starting to get a little bit lighter up on their shoulders and lighter in general, those typically do ripen inside. And you can just put them in a warm spot on some newspaper, and they'll ripen up usually within a few weeks. Just check them pretty frequently because some of them will just rot, and they will quickly turn into a gross, mushy pile. So keep an eye on them and get rid of the ones that are starting to soften in not a good way. But we've had tomatoes that we've pulled off before in years past in November.
Wow.
And towards Thanksgiving that are finally getting ripe. Yeah. So it's definitely worthwhile if you feel like it.
And if you ate a November tomato in August, you would think, this is not that great. But because you're eating it in November, it's pretty good.
Very funny. All right. Emily's in Madison Park. Hello, Emily.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. So I just recently cleared out my raised garden beds. I'm a novice gardener, and I was just curious if it's too late for me to try to, create some seedlings of like lettuce or something inside and then put them in my beds, or should I just go ahead and put a winter mulch over?
Well, can she plant some winter greens right now, Willie?
It's a little late. You could put some kale in, perhaps, if you can find starts at a nursery. It's definitely too late to start stuff inside to put in your garden if you wanted to do that yourself. But you could put the kales in. They won't do anything until next year. They'll just sort of sit there. But you can also plant garlic right now, as well as shallots. So if you are feeling the urge to get something in your bed, those are definitely really worthwhile to plant. Just remember, they'll be there until next July, though. So
put them
make sure
in the right
you plant
place.
Them in a spot that you don't mind them being there for a while.
What was the green that you were planting a couple weeks ago? Mesh?
Yeah, I did. It's been almost a month.
Oh, it's been a month
that I planted the corn salad or mosh and a couple of kales, and I thought I was kind of pushing the envelope of it being late then, but they've really took off. We had good weather for it, and they're doing great.
Well, she could always play with it, right, if she wanted to.
Yeah, the wasabi arugula, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the worst thing that can happen is the stuff just doesn't grow.
Yeah.
So, put some things in and see, maybe put them under a hoop house that's a little bit warmer. But the thing is at this time of year, it's really the light that starts to disappear, and that really makes the plant slow down.
Well, speaking of hoop houses, let Matt ask his question. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'm wondering about growing things with a larger hoop house, actually. I'm wanting to do more gardening through the winter, hoping to do lots of greens and vegetables and things, and kind of try and extend my growing season. But I'm wondering if it's worth the investment for a big hoop house like that, or if I'd have to heat it to really get it to grow.
Have you ever used a big hoop house, Marty? What's the biggest hoop house you've ever used, Willie?
I've only in my personal garden just used smaller ones. When I worked at Organic Gardening, there was a bigger greenhouse that we started season and stuff a little bit. But what you need to get is Four Season Harvest by Elliot Coleman. He is a gardener and farmer in Maine, and he's conveniently married to Barbara Damrosch, who is also a really good gardener. She has a good book called The Garden Primer. But Four Season Harvest talks about how to grow food year-round in climates as cold as Maine. And they do it with hoop houses and passive solar greenhouses. So you definitely don't need to have a greenhouse. A bigger hoop house can definitely work, especially in our climate where it's not that cold in the winter.
What have you used a hoop house, Greg?
Just smaller ones, raised bed size ones, and they really, even if you don't get things producing necessarily all through the winter, if you're late getting started this year, you still get to start everything earlier and garden later.
Great.
Throughout the season. They're really great for season extending.
All right, Matt, you got to give that a shot. If the guy in Maine can do it, come on. Here's a quick email. I don't know if you can answer this one, Greg, or any of you can, but maybe for Greg. A quarter acre pond in Port Orchard, Bruce writes, I can't find anything about proper maintenance. It's pretty stagnant, relies on groundwater. It's as low as I've ever seen it. Some kind of brown plant with large round leaf that has taken over and shades everything. Where can I find out how to maintain the pond? Everything online is about these little water attractions. So where would he go? Could he go to Extension Agent to get some help with maintaining a pond?
Yeah,
natural
through
pond.
The conservation districts will often provide that because it sounds like it's more of a natural feature.
Yeah. So what would that be?
Old
be
livestock. Farm.
So Port Orchard. So
that would
Kitsap,
be Kitsap,
right?
Conservation District if they have that service available.
And that's the place to start.
And that would, but generally, ponds. It's very normal for ponds to go through a life cycle where they get pretty skunky later in the year, and then that organic debris goes to the bottom. But I can't quite tell from that description, but there also could be an invasive wetland plant in there that's mm-hmm. taken over the whole area. So perhaps finding a way to control that and then adding a lot of native plantings to it would really create a much wider habitat value for different wildlife.
KitsapCD.org, Kitsap Conservation District. It's a place to start in Paulsbo, so not far from you. Rob is in Bellevue. Hi, Rob.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me, and thanks to the panel for being here so many weeks.
Yeah.
So I have a kind of a dream project question. I'm starting to think about how to use an acre, which sort of abuts typical Puget Sound rainforest. And the land has been planted ornamentally and then neglected for about 10 years. So what I'd like to do with this land is kind of balance a couple things. Good stewardship has to come first. I'd like to keep it in good shape for the pileated woodpeckers and so forth that are in there. But if I could put in some plants that make it work for me, too, that would be great. So I have various dreams, maybe a salamander pond, maybe some apple trees. And I know I'm going to be taking some old rhododendrons out because they could be bad for some livestock I may have in there. So I wanted to see if the panel had some ideas or some resources for me. Ideally, I don't want to take on too much of a gardening load right now, but I'd like to get it started in the right direction. Maybe a decade hence, I'll get really busy on it.
Rhododendron bad for livestock because what? There's some poison problem with them. What's the problem with rhododendron?
Yeah, the leaves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Right.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful piece of property. Where is it located?
It's not far from Bridal Trail State Park. In fact, it kind of abuts and connects to it, so we can get wildlife moving in and out, back and forth. And I know, there are a few salamander ponds here and there. I don't have an actual regular water seep, but I've got some plumbing, and so possibly I could drip some water into it if it's, reasonable, throw some tadpoles in there and give them some place to breed. But I don't really know, so I'm kind of out of my depth. Well, I'm interested in what your panel has to say.
Well, one of the ways when I have look at it from a distance is I start with, okay, what are the major problems that have to be solved? So are there any major weed infestations like, Japanese knotweed or Himalayan blackberries or anything like that?
There's some Himalayan blackberry that I'm willing to get in and get after.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if I can replace it with some natives that are equally good for the birds. I don't know about other species. I haven't gotten out my plant book and thought hard about what's there yet.
Yeah, well, going through and really assessing what you have right now is a great way to go. One thing I like to do in more of a forested setting, in a wilder setting like what you're describing, is add a lot of edible native plants. So making sure you have a good population of evergreen huckleberry and red huckleberry, because those are fun for people to eat and good for wildlife. Oregon grapes, another one that's nice to have on property that's edible. Serviceberry are all...
Yeah, and all those could work in as you take out the plants that you don't want, the large rhododendrons, and turn that into sort of a transitional zone maybe between the native area behind you, working into natives on your own property, and then maybe working toward the house you want something else. You could have your orchard and things like that. But, yeah, those would service. I love the service berry. That's one of my favorites.
I'm intrigued. Go ahead, Willie.
Oh, I was just going to say, Greg gave me a book. The guy's last name is Talamy. I think his first name is Doug. Do you remember, Greg?
Yeah.
But it's called Bringing Nature Home, and it's a really good book about, creating natural areas that are also inhabited by humans and just kind of just designing them in a smart way and how to think about it. And then John Greenlee has a couple books, too, about meadows, which it doesn't sound like quite what you're doing, but it might be worthwhile for you to kind of look at his books as well, just to kind of see, because he does sort of make these kind of, I don't know what to call them, like a cultivated natural areas.
And, of course, Russell Link's book, what, Landscaping for Wildlife?
It's for the Pacific Northwest, is what I really like about it. So it has the species are right on the money for Western Washington.
I'm intrigued by this idea of having the livestock. What animals are you going to have there that you have to, like, remove the roadies, for example?
Maybe some goats, maybe two, maybe three.
So can they coexist with the kinds of native plants you guys were talking about, service berries and the like?
Goats eat everything, so it all depends, as long as you have...
Get them first, and they'll get rid of the Himalayan blackberry for you. How's that?
But they have these great portable confinement systems now that are really quick and easy to put up, so you can just move your little goat herd around your property and keep it away from the plants you don't want them chewing on.
I see. Does that sound like what you're thinking, Rob?
Yeah, these are some great ideas. Appreciate it.
By the way, Tallamy is T-A-L-L-A-M-Y, bringing... And then Russell Link's book. All right, thank you. Interesting.
And if you're not doing anything tonight, I'll have a class on designing with plants down in Renton.
Oh, so just what he's talking about.
Yeah, and it's specifically about designing with plants and natural pest control.
And I talked over you. It is on the Green Days page. Greg put a link there. Greg Rayburn and Dan Corum, Natural Yard Care Workshop tonight. Are you doing anything, Willie, you want people to come to? They'll come down to Portland, perhaps.
I'm speaking in Salem next week on Tuesday. A little bit of a drive, but...
Well, or they're listening, and they'll come. And
I have information, which I have not posted yet, but anyone can email me or look me up on Facebook to get information about our Downton Abbey tour next May.
You're going to go to the...
It's a hybrid tour.
I want to go.
Gardens, and yes, we're going to Highclere Castle. We have a tour. We're going to Port Isaac, where they filmed Doc Martin. We're going to Oxford for all the Morrison Lewis fans and Harry Potter fans, I guess. And we're seeing gardens.
That's great. And who posted about the fall tree and shrub sale? I can't talk. Yeah. There's one at the Kruckerberg Botanical Garden in Shoreline.
MSK Nursery.
This weekend and next weekend, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you posted that.
Yeah.
Because you were Greg, and it says right there on the KUOW Green Days page.
And that's such a wonderful garden through there at the Kruckerberg Foundation.
Let me grab at least one more call here. Emerson's in West Seattle. Hi, Emerson.
Hi, yeah, how's it going? My wife and I, we just got a house, and it's got a crazy garden that's way more than we can handle, and it looks horrible. And kind of going here into the fall time, I was wondering if you had any tips that I can kind of fix it up so it doesn't look so bad over the winter.
So is it overgrown?
Yeah, we've weeded out all that we can weed out, and that's left a lot of dirt patches, and it didn't really get enough water during the dry time, and it just looks really bad and poorly cared for, and we want to maybe, I don't know, I guess I want some magic to try and make it look good.
Got any magic for him?
Fresh, always
helps. Yeah, I was just, exactly. That's a nice top dressing of arborist wood chips over, and if the beds have really poor soil, then I'd put down a layer of compost first, you know, an inch or two of compost and a couple inches of wood chips over the top of that, and that'll do wonders for making it look uniform.
And
anyway.
And you can always, if you're interested, hire a gardener to come over and talk to you about what your garden is.
Where
does
he find a gardener to do that?
I would suggest looking on plantamnesty.org, and you'll find the referral service.
All right.
Garden Help is a great garden mentors, and Garden Help, same person, Robin Haglund, is a great garden mentor locally as well.
And is that something he finds on the web, Garden Help?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Or Garden Mentor.
Garden Mentor. All right, a place to start, Emerson. All right, thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you for your phone calls. You can follow what Willie Galloway is doing at digginfood.com. She's written Grow, Cook, Eat. You can follow what Marty Wingate's doing at martywingate.com. Her book is Landscaping for Privacy. You can follow what Greg Rayburn is doing, working with landowners. He's also the co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. We'll talk to you guys again. Thank you.
Thanks. Great.
Thank you for your phone calls and your emails. Tomorrow we're going to talk about charter schools. We'll also talk about Marion McPartland, the great jazz player with Paul DeBarros, who's written a biography of her. This is Weekday.
Stick around for NPR News coming up next. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs of Seattle University, contemporary professional education in the Jesuit intellectual tradition. All 33 graduate programs and the School of Law host an open house Friday, October 19th. Details at seattleu.edu/events.
Pacific Northwest Ballet presents dance classics, but artistic director Peter Bowles says PNB is also about new work.
I think it's important to preserve those commissions and those risks that aren't even audience taste yet.
I'm Marcy Silman. Join me Saturday, November 3rd for PNB's all premiere for brand new ballets. With Front Row Center, you get discounted tickets.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.